Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me here today are Jeremy Goldcorn, my Cynica co-conspirator, and the man behind the always excellent Danwei.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Good evening, Kaiser.
And Jeremiah Jenny, Dean of China Studies at the IES program here in Beijing, doctoral candidate in history at UC Davis, and the blogger behind Jottings from the Granite Studio. A Qing historian reads the paper. An excellent blog and a must-read if you're not already reading it. A couple of bigger topics today and a bunch of smaller ones. The two big ones. First, China's decision to join Russia last weekend in vetoing a UN Security Council resolution condemning Bashar al-Assad's Ba'athist regime for its, now what, 10-month-old bloody crackdown against rebels in Syria. We're going to hear what Cynica regular Stephanie Kleine-Albrandt would have to say on this. Were she here, she's actually going to remotely join us with a commentary on this. The other big topic, which has been very much on the minds of all China watchers, are, of course, the rumors. And at this point, I should stress that they are still just rumors over former Chongqing vice mayor and PSB head Wang Lijun. Where in the world is Wang Lijun? He was removed from office earlier this month, sent on. Jeremy, our new meme for the week is 休假时治疗, right? What does that mean?
Vacation-style medical treatment.
Yeah,
perhaps holiday therapy.
Therapy, right. Holiday therapy. We are going to... So he's been sent on holidays or vacation-style therapy after apparently being... after having taken a meeting, we certainly know this, at the U.S. consulate in Chengdu earlier this week, the U.S. Embassy said it was, the U.S. State Department said it was so. We are going to look at what we know at this point and what we don't know, which, as alas, is so often the case, a whole lot more than what we do know. And, of course, how people are speculating and how they're reacting to this. But first, let us take a quick jaunt through some of the other things happening in the news this week. Jeremy, you made yourself a little list, didn't you?
Yeah, it's been kind of a surprisingly busy week. When we talked on Monday, we were wondering what we'd talk about, and now there's almost too much.
Bless Aside China. From, it always gives us
bless
stuff to
China.
Talk about.
So two interesting death penalty things. One is the return of Yao Jiaxin to the news. You may remember Yao Jiaxin was a young man in October 2010. Yao Jiaxin was a student at the Xi'an Conservatory of Music.
Right.
And apparently a child of a very well-off family. He was driving his car near the campus in October 2010, hit a 26-year-old woman, Zhang Miao, and he saw that she survived, she was injured, and she started writing down his license plate number. And when he saw that, he got out of the car and stabbed her to death, figuring that it would be rather troublesome to have a witness to his accident. The case was became very famous in China, mm-hmm. and justice was swiftly meted out with a death sentence. And it was one of those times when the death sentence is a strange thing in China. It cuts across the usual political lines. And you had a lot of people on Weibo and other
baying
places.
Baying for blood, right.
Baying for blood, saying, kill him, kill him, kill him. Anyway, why it's in the news again is the father of the victim, Zhang Miao, is now asking, demanding 200,000 yuan compensation from the parents of Yao Jiaxin, whereas previously he'd turned the money down, saying, basically, you can't buy me off.
And so how are netizens reacting to his sudden change of mind on this?
I don't know. It doesn't. I think people are. It's one of those things that I don't think is really a particular opinion is crystallizing. People are just talking about it, but they're not really saying he's bad or not. It's a little bit complicated. His lawyer said, "Look, the parents, the Yao family, offered you money and you refused it, and now you're suddenly demanding it again."
And this isn't in lieu of an execution. I mean, it's still there's still.
Yeah, well, he's dead. So
I'm sorry.
He was executed. Yeah, so he's
that.
Gone.
Can I erase my idiocy just then?
Yeah, yeah. To get rid
record,
of
Kaisers. Extirpate my idiocy from the record there.
So
no, I'm serious, Dave. Please, I don't want to be exposed as an idiot.
So that was Yao Jiaxin back in the news. Next thing that's been in the news again is microblog registrations, real name registrations. So The Beijing government, it seems, are now demanding that March the 16th is the deadline for the much-talked-about real name registration.
Beware the day after the Ides of March.
That's right. And quite a funny little side story to that. Bill Bishop, a frequent guest on this podcast, and me were quoted in a China Daily story as foreigners who are confused about the regulations because the regulations say you need to use your Chinese ID number to register, and we don't have one. Neither do some of the what the China Daily says, 8 million Weibo accounts being accessed from overseas. What are those people going to do if they're not Chinese citizens? So March is going to be an interesting month for people who follow Weibo.
So now user numbers are precipitously down. Is that correct? Ever since these new regulations were announced, I mean, prior to the announcement of real name registration, Sino Weibo at least was gaining 20 million new users a month on average. And once they were imposed, that seems to have fallen, according at least like TechRice by Kai Lukoff, and I know Bill Bishop wrote about this as well, down to 3 million a month.
But that also may be an effect of the fact that they've basically already got everybody in China who's interested in the service. I mean, when you already have, you know, more than 250 million registered users, that's half of the internet population. And I don't think everybody wants to be on Weibo, even though, you know, the cool kids are.
Well, they're all going to have to come under the real name thumb once sooner or later. I mean, Sohu so far hasn't. Tencent and NetEase both have. Sohu, I mean, I can't see how they would avoid this either. I think Bill suggests that some of these may be just because zombie accounts and people who have sort of, you know, spam accounts and no way of actually obtaining verification are understanding now that they're not going to be able to do that, which is actually going to make for a better user experience. In the end, what do you think Weibo is going to look like after March 16th, Jeremy?
If they do enforce it, it's going to be less fun, for sure. A lot of Chinese people don't want to use their real names, don't want to give their real names, and feel free to speak their mind because they're anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will change the culture of Weibo, and I don't think there's the doubt in my mind is if they will successfully implement the real name system.
One of the interesting things in the last month, too, has been the China Media Project and some other websites have been collecting the deleted posts from Sina Weibo, showing the kind of things people have said that did not make it past the internal censors for Sina. And these things run the gamut from personal attacks and spam messages, the kind of things that most people would feel, okay, it kind of makes sense to be deleted. But also, it's been interesting the kind of political posts, or at least, political posts that have also not made the cut.
So I guess we would be remiss if we didn't talk at least a little bit about Pete Hextra's oh-so-silly Super Bowl attack ad.
Before we get on to that, let's stick with China itself.
Oh, this, okay,
I forgot to mention another death penalty case that's been in the news again. Which is the entrepreneur Wu Ying, a woman born in 1981 in Zhejiang, who became fabulously wealthy. She started a beauty parlor, then a car rental business, then sold some kind of quackish beauty remedy, and then managed to start, you know, possibly more than 20 companies named the Binse Group, various different companies.
Binse Group, yeah.
Made it onto the rich list of China in 2006 at the age of 25. She was said to be the 68th richest person in China. And then was accused of basically defrauding investors. And given the death penalty, in 2009, she was given the death penalty, and the case has been dragging on. She's been appealing it. The death penalty was, in fact, upheld on the 18th of January, so just before Spring Festival, by the Zhejiang Provincial Court. And the case is now being considered by the Supreme Court of China. Again, death penalty, interesting, it cuts across political lines. So today, for example, Hu Xijin, the editor of the Global Times, who's famous for his rants against the West and defense of the government and the Communist Party, was tweeting and writing opinion pieces about how she should be spared.
I think that Twitter has done something to Hu Xijin. I mean, he seems to have moderated a bit. I don't know. I mean, maybe the editorial line generally of the Global Times has, but I'm wrong here. But just since he's made his debut on Twitter, and of course I'm following him, seeing what he has to say, he seems to have actually chilled a bit.
He's not an idiot. And he does say many reasonable things. He just says other unreasonable things as well.
Oh yeah, I gotta get back to this. We were saying, I mean, you know, we can't do this show without talking at least a little bit about Pete Hoekstra's Super Bowl attack ad against his opponent, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Debbie, spend it now. He, of course, created a website called DebbieSpendItNow.com and a now famous or infamous 30-second spot, which was created by a ad guy who does a lot of work for the GOP. If you've been living in a cave, you haven't seen this thing. But, of course, everyone now by now has seen it a dozen times. You know, it's got this – well, Jeremiah, why don't you help me describe this thing?
It's a bizarre mashup of what perhaps a GOP ad man would have put together if he was drawing this on the back of a cocktail napkin at his local walk and roll restaurant, thinking, how am I going to depict China for this ad? And, you know, I think that was one of the reactions among Chinese netizens when they looked at it was,
they ain't China.
What the hell? What country are they talking about here? I mean, it was so surreal that I think most people kind of slipped over the whole, wow, this is really racist, to, wow, this is just truly, truly bizarre.
So why don't we actually take a listen to what the young woman says in this actual advertisement.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Spendetnow. Debbie spends so much American money. You borrow more and more from us. Your economy get very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spendetnow.
I think this race for U.S. Senate is between Debbie Spendetnow and Pete Spendetnot. I'm Pete Spendetnot Hoekstra, and I approve this message.
When was that ad that featured the Chinese professor who actually spoke in proper Mandarin?
That was last year.
That was just last year.
I must say, because I think that what I detested about this ad was not so much the racism, but the appalling production quality and lack of authenticity. First of all, you know, it was quite clear to anyone who has any experience or knowledge of Asian people and Asia that it didn't look like China, particularly. The woman was clearly an Asian American pretending to speak broken English.
Right. I mean, she spoke perfectly accented American English, but with just sort of, I mean, it was like, your economy get very weak.
It was fake broken English. And the website associated with that video looks like some kind of cheap kind of AsianSluts.com. I mean, it basically, right. The design sense is like porn.
Yeah, very
I'm shocked they couldn't have gotten Biling to do that. I mean, $50 in a bus ticket.
No, I mean, it was funny. Some clever person actually looked at the HTML code, and you know what they dropped in for that video was yellow girl. They then later changed it to yellow shirt girl to indicate that it wasn't, you know, overtly racist. Now, what killed me was the kind of the chop suey Chinese menu font that they used through the whole thing.
The and Shandong then, Airlines plane in the, right, on the website, right, was kind of cute.
Yeah, that was funny.
I thought there was one clever netizen that said, and this was mentioned in some of the pieces, when he said, looking at all the hats, it goes, well, I guess they just can't get our minority hats correct.
Right. What would you, I think one of the more interesting takes on this was, what are the visual dog whistles? I mean, Jim Fallows was kind of the first person out the gate writing on this on his Atlantic blog, and he talked about sort of visual dog whistles. I mean, the one that was obvious to me when I first saw this thing was sort of Apocalypse Now / Full Metal Jacket / you kind of half expected this woman to riding up to take that hat hanging on her back and then take a grenade out of it and blow up the viewer, right?
That's what it is, though.
Right.
That's the image they're going for. This is the thought of, my goodness, these are the people that we remember from Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, what have you, and now they're rising up and they have the power. And, of course, what are they going to do with it? Which
they're
going
to blow us the f*** up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, thank you for the napalm and your job. I mean, it's the most bizarre mashup of – generic Asian racism, and as Jeremy pointed out, it done poorly. I mean, though I'm not sure racism done poorly is any worse than racism done well, but
I prefer my racism done really well.
Well, I watched just before in preparation for this podcast, Mr. Hoekstra defending himself on Fox News, of course, where he was granted a rather sympathetic interview. And he was saying that's not the point. You know, the point is that China's eating our lunch. But the problem is if the people in the United States like this are so totally clueless about China, you know, what's going to stop China from continuing to eat America's lunch? It's an indication of ignorance.
Clearly, you know, government spending had no part in China's, quick recovery from the 2008. let's move on from that. I mean, that was funny. I guess maybe one perfunctory comment about how Chinese reacted to this, which was just sort of, I mean, I didn't see a lot of people in righteous indignation screaming about racism. I thought they were just sort of getting a good laugh about the whole thing, right? That was my sense.
Well, sometimes when we sort of the Lawai commentariat, when we see articles that are written about foreigners in China, occasionally that gets Twitter going if it's particularly close to the bone or something. But when it's just an outlandish kind of thing, like yes, foreigners come to China and they are all imperialist stooges and whatever, you know, that kind of thing, we just kind of laugh it off as like generic, you know, histrionic state media blather, right?
Right.
I think this is the same thing. I think a lot of people looked at this and went, this is so utterly ludicrous. I'm not going to get bunched up about this. The ones that are a little bit closer to home, the ones with a little bit higher production values, the ones that frankly are a little bit more subtle,
are
the ones that get attention. The Chinese professor one's a good example of that.
That's going to actually draw more attention, right? This was just sort of dismissed out of hand. Let's move on to Syria, onto the Syria veto. And why don't we start by giving a listen to what our colleague Stephanie Kleine-Albrandt, who, of course, is with the International Crisis Group, has to say on the matter.
From China's perspective, its veto of the Syria resolution was in large part actually an anti-Libya statement in the sense of opposing the Western-led regime change and UN mandate stretch that China already widely criticized about the Libya operation. So the concern in this case was to ensure that China was not authorizing any kind of action that could lead to anything even approximating the Libya intervention. And I think you can go so far as to say that Security Council Resolution 1973 on Libya actually created a sort of a deep trauma for the Chinese, but also the Russians. Obviously, Gaddafi's ugly televised death was quite shocking to Chinese. And for all these reasons, Chinese diplomats and scholars have actually said that the government regretted not having vetoed 1973. But another significant impetus behind the veto was to follow the Russians, who were pursuing their own perceived or real national interests. As Minson Pei has pointed out, the double veto has become a tool used for mutual cover, and Syria is sufficiently important to Russia that it could even have been put the arrangement in jeopardy if China had refused. And of course, conversely, this buys important credit with Russia when China needs them in the future for a quid pro quo. P3 diplomats in New York, and those are the three permanent members aside from Russia and China, see the Russian reaction as very conservative, defensive and lacking imagination rather than any type of proactive way of finding a solution. They say they actually gave space for a Russian role during the negotiations on the last draft resolution, but the Russians didn't really have any serious initiative to propose. However, some of these diplomats also admit that the, quote, Assad should go line was perhaps in some ways a PR mistake and that it undercut potential Russian attempts to try mediating in Syria. I've also actually heard that neither Russia nor China particularly like the, quote, New Arab League, the one led by Saudi, Qatar, and other Gulf countries, which they, of course, see as allies of the West and as used to support this campaign against Iran. So this current Arab League promoting intervention in Libya and Syria is certainly not the Arab League they thought they knew before. I also heard that Russia is waiting for Iraq to take the presidency of the Arab League in March to resume dialogue with the Arabs on the Syria crisis. Having said all that, though, there is still no serious transition plan or mediation initiative put forward by any member of the P5. The P3 was hoping that a unanimously voted resolution would have sent a political signal to Assad, but short of that, they really don't know what else to do. And after the double veto, it's really hard to see what can be expected from the Security Council in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah, so just to clarify, the Minxin Pei piece that she alluded to was in the New York Times. It was an opinion piece that China scholar Pei Minxin or Minxin Pei had written that was basically talking about this as it's all about Russia. For China, this – and I think Stephanie largely echoes this. It's about keeping a chip ready to cash for quid pro quo with Moscow. Is that how you guys see it essentially? Do you think that there's something deeper behind this?
Well, I agree largely with Stephanie and with Minxin Pei on this. I think that in this case, China doesn't have a lot of skin in this game. Unlike other countries, China doesn't have a significant amount of economic or other ties with Syria. But they need Russia's support on issues that they do care about. You know, the use of the veto in the Security Council sends a very powerful message. It opens up the countries that use the veto to a lot of international criticism. How much China and Russia or Beijing and Moscow care about that criticism is possibly open to some debate. But if, you know, in this case, Russia feels very strongly about this, they need China for a certain amount of international cover. And frankly, if Russia told China in this case to vote for a regime that was run by a syphilitic honey badger, they probably would, just in case that, you know, in the future, if something comes up with Sudan or something even closer to home, they have Russia's support.
The other main line of interpretation that I've heard is, of course, that this is consistent with China's foreign policy. In 1973, the UN resolution that all basically paved the way for taking military action against the Gaddafi regime in Libya was an aberration, that ordinarily anything that would empower the UN to take any kind of an action to interfere with what they regard as the internal affairs of any member nation, China just sort of uniformly opposes. That doesn't seem to be exactly what Stephanie or Minxin Pei are saying here.
Well, I mean, I think part of it too, and there is a part of it too that isn't just real politic. It's easy, I think, for the West to dismiss Chinese criticisms about getting involved in internal affairs, especially militarily, as blowing a bit of smoke to cover their own kind of political anxieties. But I mean, really, if you take the long view, and the Chinese government does, and certainly Chinese people do, it's not hard to understand why all these events in the current day are seen in the context of China's, you know, the last 100, 200 years of Chinese history. You know, you have a relatively trumped up reason to intervene militarily in a country causing significant amount of damage. Now, I know there's a lot of people in the West who think, okay, well, that's just, you know, stirring up nationalist feelings and old wounds to kind of cover for contemporary political objectives. And yeah, I imagine some of that does happen. But I don't think it's very hard to sell this idea to people living in China who are brought up with these stories. And certainly when I talk to people in China, when I listen to talk radio, you know, you hear this all the time. Just last year, Fang Bingxing, who's the father of the Great Firewall, gave a somewhat histrionic graduation speech at the Beijing University of Posts and Telecommunications, and he's talking about Libya, he's talking about North Africa, and he's calling, you know, the airstrikes there part of a new 8-country allied army, referencing the allied force that came in and put down the Boxers. And you know, I think there was a lot of people from outside China who were like, God, that's kind of a stretch, isn't it? But not, I don't think from his point of view it was, and I think people do legitimately kind of see it in that light.
I think there's also something else. Looking at the stories about this in the British and American press and the comment sections, and then also at some of the writings that have appeared. For example, Kaiser, you sent us a piece on Asia Times Online by
Pepe Escobar, right?
Who is, you know, very reliably knee-jerk anti-American, and you know, nonetheless represents a very common way of thinking about this kind of thing. So if you look at The Guardian and Pepe Escobar's piece, you have a lot of people saying, "Well, you know, America does the same thing with Israel." Whether you agree with that or not, I mean, there is...
You mean in terms of vetoing resolutions?
Vetoing resolutions, you know, obstructing UN attempts to regulate what many people see as injustice going on. It does happen. It's not just China who does that, but they have different friends.
I mean, in addition to sort of taking the U.S. to task for alleged hypocrisy by constantly vetoing anything that would be punitive against Israel, Escobar, I mean, he can be pretty much reliably counted on to offer a bracing challenge to the Western narrative. This time, I mean, he really goes after the sort of what he calls the sort of NATO GCC effort to plunge Syria into a civil war, to effect regime change and install some puppet friendly to the United States. I mean, that's essentially what his line of argument is.
And I mean, he himself, I think, is just, you know, 1 millimeter short of being a kind of loony conspiracy theorist when it comes to a lot of what goes on in the world. He's sort of what would happen if Noam Chomsky hadn't started out as a professor of linguistics, but had started out as a foreign correspondent. So perhaps one can take what he says with a pinch of salt. Nonetheless, I do think that he is representative of the way a lot of Chinese people think and a lot of people all over the world think.
Let's talk about what Chinese people think. Has this generally, the reaction to the veto, has it, you know, fallen out along with predictable lines of polarization, you know, liberal versus nationalist? I mean, I saw an awful lot of sort of, you know, we are sorry, we're ashamed of our government for having done this veto, but I saw a lot of comments that was saying, you know, quite the opposite, that this was the right thing for China to have done here.
Well, I mean, certainly the way the whole situation in North Africa from last year to this year has been portrayed in the Chinese media and the state media, especially the television media, it's portrayed in a way that emphasizes absolutely the most negative and horrible aspects of the, you know, regime change, if you will, in North Africa over the last year. But at the same time, it does sort of speak that in looking at the Escobar piece, thinking of the way Chinese netizens have reacted, or Chinese citizens have reacted, you know, I don't think that the U.S. and maybe the U.S. doesn't care about this, but I don't think they're making the case in a way that that reaches, for example, people who aren't already on board with a kind of pro-Western stance. This notion that, you know, China should be ashamed of itself, that the blood will be on the hands of Beijing and Moscow. You know, I think that when people read that in China, it's not the right tack to take. And so far, the U.S. and the West hasn't made a case for why Syria and Russia should get on board with this with their plan for Syria that makes sense to Russia and Chinese people. At least the ones that, you know, have been expressing their views to me and online. But that's, I mean, again, whether or not the U.S. really cares about that is a whole other question.
Right. I mean, I think Russia and China both signaled they'd be down with a condemnation of his use of force, but they crossed the line in calling for, you know, him to actually step down, calling for what they said was unequivocal.
There's also a real politic thing. I mean,
right.
There's Tarsus, not a lot of information about what's going on in Syria. A lot of the it is true. A lot of the information we're getting is coming from, anti-government forces, and there's no reason to think that they're making it up or not telling the truth. But at the same time, getting real kind of confirmation of what the situation is on the ground, and a lot of what the UN Security Council was predicated on, is a fairly optimistic assumption about the kind of forces available to oppose the forces of the government. And I don't know right now if we really know what those forces look like. I mean, we know that there's killings, we know that there's bombings, we know the government is certainly taking a very strong stance, especially in the last few days, but we don't know much about the nature of the opposition to them, how organized it is, and how ready it would be to actually take on the government.
Okay, well, let's move on to our final topic for the evening, which is the rumors surrounding what happened Tuesday night in Chengdu at about 1 a.m. And I learned of this, not surprisingly, from Bill Bishop in the morning. There was some commotion around the U.S. consulate in Chengdu with a police cordon, and as some have suggested, there was the removal of an official SUV with Chongqing plates on it. Jeremy, tell us first, who is Wang Lijun? How did he rise to prominence, and why, as far as you can tell, was he removed from office earlier this month?
Wang Lijun is famous as the top cop of Chongqing, working under Bo Xilai to bust the mafia, the triads of the huge city of Chongqing. He's actually Mongolian ethnically and from the northeast, but he became famous working under Bo Xilai.
In Dalian first, right?
Yeah.
He came with him from Dalian, right?
Yeah. And then went to Chongqing. And he and Bo Xilai both have a touch of the theatrical about him. I mean, Wang Lijun is supposed to be a martial arts expert, and they've been commissioning books, plays, and films, apparently, about their exploits.
In Chongqing, yeah.
Yeah, I think even some of this even started when they were in the northeast. And, you know, he was seen as Bo Xilai's sedang, his, like, trusted, you know, brother-in-arms. So it's what's happened seems to be a split with Bo Xilai, or at least something has gone very wrong. Because shortly after these rumors emerged on Twitter and Weibo about him potentially seeking refuge in the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, at 11 a.m., 11:06 a.m.,
we had the official tweet from...
Right. We have the official tweet. Thursday, February the 2nd. Excuse me, sorry. Could you change that? On February the 8th, within, you know, less than 10 hours of the photos circulating on Weibo of the fuss at the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, the Chongqing City Information Office published a tweet on Weibo saying... according to reports, because of long-term overwork, a state of anxiety and indisposition, Vice Mayor Wang Lijun has agreed to accept vacation-style medical treatment. So he was the vice mayor in addition to being the cop. A week before that, the Chongqing Information Office had announced that he would no longer be in charge of policing activities in Chongqing, but would be given a new portfolio consisting of economics and gardening, or something that sounded not like a promotion.
Right. It wasn't a lateral move at all. I mean, it was fairly clearly sort of a step down for him.
So rumors circulating about him trying to defect at the American consulate, the Chongqing Information Office, in other words, the propaganda arm of the Chongqing government, sends out this tweet saying he's going on vacation-style medical treatment. And the whole day, February the 8th, that was yesterday for us, was an extraordinary amount of discussion of this on the Chinese internet, particularly on Weibo, with people making all kinds of speculations about what was really going on.
And most of the speculations were sort of centered around this rumor that he had perhaps offered to defect to the American consulate, and that he had been somehow rebuffed and handed over, possibly, to Chinese authorities. This question was put directly to Victoria Nuland, who is a State Department spokesperson, and I wrote down what was said here. The question from an unnamed journalist says, I've got one on another subject, Ms. Nuland. Please, yes. Question. Specifically, these reports coming out of China that a deputy mayor of Chongqing had sought refuge at the consulate in Chengdu and that there had been an unexpected increase in security personnel around the consulate for a while. Can you tell us what about any of this, Ms. Nuland? Well, I think you're referring to reports about the vice mayor of Chongqing, right, Chongqing City. So his name is Wang Lijun. Wang Lijun did request a meeting at the U.S. Consulate General in Chengdu earlier this week in his capacity as vice mayor. The meeting was scheduled. Our folks met with him. He did visit the consulate, and he later left the consulate of his own volition. So, and obviously we don't talk about issues having to do with refugee status, asylum, etc. Question. Okay, but so can you tell us exactly when that meeting took place? Ms. Nuland, I believe... We're here on Wednesday. I believe it was Monday, but if that is not right, we will get back to you. Anyway, it goes on for a while, and I mean, they focus on this business about leaving on his own volition, to which she says, well, again, there's been some reporting to indicate that that might not have been the case, but it was the case. Question from the journalist. Okay. The reporting being that he had been forced to leave or that he had been dragged out or Ms. Nuland... unusual reporting about all this. Just to affirm for you that he walked out, it was his choice. Now, one of the more interesting reports that I've seen on this came out just this afternoon before I headed over to do the recording. It was from John Garneau, who's a regular guest on this show. He writes for a couple of Australian papers. His piece was, I don't know if you got a chance to see it, China Power Play, Anti-Corruption Officials Vanish. And he talks about how Wang Lijun was the right-hand man of the most polarizing politician in China, Bo Xilai, of course, that his relationship, he says, collapsed last month under the pressure of an investigation team from the Central Commission for Discipline and Inspection, according to a Chongqing source who has had recent dealings with both Mr. Wang and the commission. Several of Mr. Wang's close associates from his home base of Dalian, this is what he says, have also been taken into custody, according to Chongqing sources. Of course, I am in no position to verify any of this, but very interesting what's being said here.
There was also, I think, maybe worth mentioning a report that appeared on a Taiwanese website, which claimed that as he was leaving the embassy, Wang Lijun was screaming that Bo Xilai is a careerist. I will fight him to the death. Materials documenting his crimes have already been sent abroad.
Right. We have. I mean, that's one source, and it's not well sourced, right?
No, none of this stuff is well sourced. Right. It's all rumor.
Right.
And I think that's one of the most interesting parts of this is not so much the story, but the way the rumors are being spread and believed. And, you know, as we get closer to the leadership transition at the end of this year and the beginning of next year, a lot of the attention is going to be obviously focused on those top spots. But it's how that transition shakes down through the ranks of the party and through the ranks of the state apparatus, you know, as different patronage networks are reshuffled, reconfigured, and placed into the key positions, that I think is going to be where a lot of the toughest fighting and a lot of the nastiest infighting is going to occur. Bo Xilai is obviously a very high-profile figure, but I think this is just going to be the first of many cases like this where we're going to have officials who are going to be linked or at least doing things that would ordinarily seem quite outlandish by Chinese political terms. It's the same week, I believe, that in Beijing, you know, there was a corruption case that, you know, uncovered literally mountains of money in a villa in the Western Hills. I mean, I think these stories are going to be leaked out as different factions, as different people
jostle for
these jobs. And I think this is just the first one. I think we're going to be seeing a few of these coming up this summer.
Not sure. I mean, there is nobody who is being weighed for a Politburo Standing Committee spot who is nearly as controversial as Bo Xilai has been, right?
Well, I don't think so. But, I think that, and as I said, Bo Xilai is a rather high-profile figure. But I think these kind of corruption cases, because they tend to affect or they tend to play out along patronage lines, are going to proliferate this year, because I think there's going to be a certain amount of leaking about these stories as different factions kind of, you know, seek a certain upper hand. And, you know, there's already been some speculation. And again, we're indulging in wanton speculation, so what the hell? You know, that the blocking and unblocking or the possible blocking of Wang Lijun's name on Sina Weibo and other forums has been because there are, you know, the theory is that there are people who aren't too unhappy to see Bo Xilai's reputation take a little tarnish.
And it's worth noting, I think, two things. One, that it has been remarkably free. I mean, you can still post on it and search. I mean, the search has gone on and off, but it's still, you can post on this affair without censorship, basically, on Weibo. It's not being controlled very heavily. The second thing to note is I don't think anybody's interpreting this as being good for Bo Xilai.
Oh, no, nobody is. Absolutely.
So it's definitely, I mean, no matter some how kind of black out. Mark, right?
Right. There's a cloud. I mean, there's a cloud. This is certainly something that we're going to revisit in weeks to come. But let's move on to our recommendations for the week. Jeremiah, what you got for us this week?
Oh, the Linsanity. For those of you sports fans out there who miss Yao Ming, Jeremy Lin, the Harvard-educated guard for the New York Knicks, has been going off in a scoring binge, making Chinese sports fans forget their 7'6" and fragile-footed former hero.
I mean, this is no fluke. I mean, this is like the third game where he scored more than 20 points now.
Yeah, but this is all, I mean, not to get too much into inside basketball, but in Mike D'Antoni's system, I could probably go for 20 points just because he's got a a system that says throw the ball in the general direction of the basket no matter where you are or who you are. So this isn't unusual, but it's kind of exciting, and not the least of which, it's kind of fun to watch an Ivy League player banging with the big boys.
Yeah, Jeremy Lin.
Jeremy Lin. Well, good. You know, popularize my name here, even though I'm afraid I don't understand the sport really.
Let's just hope he doesn't appropriate your Chinese name and think I'll start calling him Jimmy.
No, not with a surname like Lin. So I have two recommendations, two blogs that I've started enjoying, and you know, we've had a podcast previously about the state of the English language blogosphere about China. And sometimes when I see a new blog come along, I kind of think, oh, God, why is this necessary? But there are two that I think recently have been proving their worth. One is Seeing Red in China.
Absolutely. Seeing Red in China.
SeeingRedInChina.com. And another one is much newer. And I look at it and I wonder if they're going to be able to maintain the same enthusiasm, but they've been pretty good so far in the couple of weeks that I've been following them, TeaLeafNation.com.
Yeah, I read a piece on Tea Leaf Nation today. Bill Bishop had linked to it. It was excellent. Very, very good stuff. Do you know anything about who's behind Tea Leaf Nation?
They have the unfortunate tendency of most of them are – they were anonymous when I first noticed the blog, and then they have one member now who actually uses his name, and his name is – oh, no, now he's removed his name. I'm just looking. I can't see his name. Okay.
Ah, well.
Anyway, hopefully they will at some point put their real names there, because I'm a fairly big believer in – I don't mind – I think Chinese people should use pseudonyms on Weibo if possible, but I think foreigners who blog about China should use their real names.
Now, what was the piece that I read today? I'm spacing now. Do you...
The few good ones that they've had, one has been about a kind of Wuhan-style
uprising.
Oh,
right. It was about...
In Zhejiang.
Wuhan 2.0, right?
Yeah, Panzhou. I think that's one of the more interesting things they've
That was what I saw.
Recently. Right. And if I may just go back to Seeing Red in China, they've got something that they've just published, a two-part by a guy named Ge Xun, a little record of a rather unpleasant encounter with China's security services. So also worth reading.
I've got just one recommendation for the week, which is Edward Bertinsky's Manufactured Landscapes. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah.
It's a
second that.
2006. It's a documentary. Bertinsky is famous for doing these sort of super large format, very high resolution pictures, photography. I mean, he's an excellent photographer. Much of what he does in this documentary is actually shot in the factory city of Dongguan, where most of the world's shit is made. It's just a crazy place, and just the opening sequence of that documentary is this. Continuous dolly shot that moves you all through this factory, which is, I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of meters long. I mean, it may be longer. I mean, it's taking you along this production line, a continuous shot. It's absolutely mind-blowing. And of course, I thought of this after having, you know, read quite a bit about Foxconn and about, I think anyone who really wants to understand the manufacturing landscape in China really needs to see this documentary. Edward Bertinsky, Manufactured Landscapes, 2006. Please see it. Jeremiah, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Kaiser.
Thank you, Kaiser. My surname is not Lin.
Okay, so we'll see you guys next week on the Seneca Podcast. Thanks for listening. Take care.